Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
The boxers have been given their instructions. The seconds are out. The crowd is ready for another edition of Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing with your presenter, the boxing historian, Greg Rashid.
And I want to say swaddy cup to everyone out there. This is Greg Rashid with another edition of the Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast. And yes, if you're new to the program, I'm in Bangkok, Thailand, loving retirement, but loving doing the show. Just love doing the show. And I want to thank so many folks all over the world who are sending their compliments, who offer suggestions as far as fantasy fights, because we usually do fantasy fights on this program, and also we talk about what's going on in the world boxing currently. But this is a special show, and as I have said in the past, because it's my show, I can do whatever I want with the program. And today I am just so honored to have Tom Shanahan, who's the author of an amazing book. He is on a journey to get people to know about the history of integration of college football in the 1960s. But before we have our interview with Tom, I'm going to have our buddy Knockout Nigel come on, because even though we're not talking about current boxing right now, we won't do a fantasy fight today, he's going to give you just a under 2 minute history of boxing. And so we're going to have Knockout Nigel talk about that. So take it away, Knockout Nigel.
Cheers. This is Knockout Nigel. I would like to tell you a little about the origins of boxing. Boxing is one of the oldest known sports today, with 2,000-year-old depictions on the walls of tombs in Egypt and stone carvings indicating that Sumerians, who lived in what is now Iraq, boxed at least 5,000 years ago. Boxing got its start as an exhausting and brutal spectacle. In ancient Greece, two men would sit face to face with their fists tightly wrapped in strips of tough leather. They would then hit each other until one of them fell to the ground unconscious, or even worse, dead. Roman fighters or gladiators, on the other hand, fought with the primary intent to kill their opponent, wearing leather straps around their fists, plated with metal. However, boxing was soon abolished around 393 AD because it was deemed too savage. Boxing didn't really resurface again until the early 16th century in London. You see, the English aristocracy developed a keen interest in recovering the knowledge and tradition of antiquity, so boxing became a means to handle disputes among the rich. Wealthy patrons would support their pugilists and put large wages down on their fights. This is actually where the term prize fighters was coined. I hope you enjoyed that brief history of boxing. This is Knockout Nigel, returning you to our Bangkok studio as I prepare to sip some bubbly. Cheers! My God! This bubbly is ghastly. It tastes like it is about 5,000 years old.
I tell you, Knockout Nigel on this bubbly, but he is so popular. I mean, he's getting his own fan club on the internet. It's just amazing. But I hope you enjoyed that little history of boxing. From time to time, we'll have more of this little fascinating facts about boxing and all. But right now, we're having a fascinating interview with Tom Shanahan, who's written a superb book, The Right Thing to Do, The True Pioneers of College Football Integration in the 1960s. This is one of my favorite interviews, and I've been doing interviews for over 20 years. I really enjoy talking to Tom and reading his book, and I know you will enjoy this interview too. So we're going to get to the interview right now. So let's listen to it on the Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast. And I am so honored today to have on my program a gentleman who I just, now he's very modest, but I think what he's done should make him a name known throughout all the sports, as far as sports history in particular, because what he, the books he has put out, especially this new one that he just put out, The Right Thing to Do, it is just, it's just an amazing book on just the history of the true pioneers of college football integration in the 1960s. And I, you know, and some of you who know me and listen to me over the years since 2001 know, you know, my love with sports. You follow some of my sports programs and some of my history and news programs about Black history. But there are so many things I learned in this new book that I didn't know. And I really want to just thank the author of this book who is on right now. And I have to say this, I know some of you are saying, well, you know, you changed this to a boxing program. No, it is, but remember, it's my program. And I said, you know, when I began this program, you know, a year ago, that I can put on anyone I want when it comes to history and just learning and seeking knowledge. And I'm just honored to have on today. And he has a great last name. For those of you who are listening on KUHS in Denver, Colorado, I'm talking about Tom Shanahan. He is a prize-winning author, sports writer, wrote for many years out, I believe, in San Diego. And I think now you're in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, Tom?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, but really just a great guy. And this book is really amazing, The Right Thing to Do. It's on, if I'm not mistaken, August Publications. Is that the name?
That's correct.
Yeah, it's really a great book. And I just want to thank you for coming on today. And first of all, I want to ask, because one thing I didn't catch in the book, and I looked on your, and you got a, by the way, you got a fabulous website. That's another, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to ask you when we get off air, who, you know, maybe you created the website yourself, but it's fabulous. It's one of the best websites I've seen. I mean, the information you have on there and how you lay it out is fabulous.
Thank you.
But I want to ask
you. It's a labor of love.
Yeah, I can, you know, that comes out in your book. But, I, you know, one thing I didn't catch, and I want you to, maybe I missed it in reading the book and looking online, but what, you know, what inspired you to really get into this whole thing about integration of college football in the 1960s? I know you're a grad of Michigan State, and I'm a grad of Ohio State University, but what was the thing, the one spark that said, you know, why, you know, this is a forgotten story. What is this?
Yeah.
And we know, you know, and I know you're going to talk about the whole thing about Bear Bryant, but what was the initial, the spark that said, hey, I got to look into this.
Yeah, well, I was actually born in Cleveland. So I might have been on a path to Ohio State too, but my father got a job as a professor at Ferris State University, which is in Big Rapids, Michigan, north of Michigan State.
Okay.
And when we moved there, that was about the time that Bubba Smith and George Webster and Jimmy Ray were all playing for the Spartans, and they had this great team. And my family was always socially conscious. We were Kennedy voters, supporters of Martin Luther King and what he stood for. And I always knew, even as a kid, I was only in elementary school when they were playing, that there was something different about the Michigan State teams, that they had a lot of Black players. And most in particular, that they had a Black quarterback, because back in those days, there were no Black quarterbacks.
Right.
So I was always aware of this, and it was always in the back of my brain. I always loved history. And as my career went along in sports writing, I also, when I was a kid, I read Harry Edwards' book, the Sociology of Sport,
right,
and learned about his role in the 1968 Olympics. So I always loved history, But you know, when you become a sports writer, you kind of grind away at things. And as my sports writing career was winding down, I was fortunate in my time in San Diego to get to know Jimmy Ray's son, who is Jimmy Ray III. He was in the front office with the Chargers. And I approached him about hooking me up with his dad because, and what I told his dad was, you know, I don't think the Underground Railroad story has ever been properly told. We just have a thin outline of it that has right. been spread in college football lore. And then, of course, all the Michigan State players, Jimmy Ray, Clinton Jones, Bob Apiza, the first Samoan All-American from Hawaii, because Duffy also had that Hawaii pipeline. Unfortunately, by the time I got to it, Bubba Smith and George Webster and Charlie Thornhill had all been passed away. But I was able to not only get, I got the cooperation from them, full cooperation. And I just started coming up with more things than I ever expected to find. The primary thing being that for the most part, the sports media of the 60s avoided race. So these milestones that Michigan State was recording and other black athletes were recording were simply being ignored. And that's right. what black historiography and critical race theory is all about. It's been politicized, but all that means is you're telling the story of a history of how it was told or wasn't told. And in this case, there is a ton of stuff to tell about what Michigan State, Duffy Doherty, the Underground Railroad did to influence college football integration.
Definitely. And, you know, it's funny. I'm, you know, at that time, I'm a kid. I'm 12 years old in Washington, D.C. I'm, you know, I remember that game. It was the game of the century. You know, Notre Dame versus Michigan State. And I was so focused on, and this is what the media was doing back then. They were talking about Bubba Smith as far as kill Bubba, kill. That was a big slogan. And I didn't even notice. And I remember getting Sports Illustrated at the time too. It didn't occur to me that the quarterback was black. And there was no mention, I could be wrong, but from what I remember in the article I read in Sports Illustrated, there was no real mention about Jimmy Ray.
Yeah,
it was all about Bubba Smith. I was like, man.
Yeah.
And until I read your book, you know, it's like it never occurred to me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Dan Jenkins was the godfather of college football writing in Sports Illustrated. He covered the game, and his only reference to Jimmy Ray was that he had a thin mustache. So there you go again. They just weren't ready to handle reporting on this change that was going on, because Duffy Doherty was so far ahead of the game. You know, there would maybe be casual references that Bubba Smith was from Beaumont, Texas, but as I explained in my books, there was no illustration. You could see it on the TV screen for yourself, but there was no examination in news reports or sports reports. And shows that here was Michigan State with 20 black players, 11 black starters, two black team captains, College Football Hall of Famers George Webster and Clinton Jones, voted by a predominantly white team, and then Jimmy Ray, the South's first black quarterback to win a national title. Meanwhile, Notre Dame only had one black player, Alan Page. And that's the way it was back then because, and this is something that I began to put together in my research. In those days, schools didn't want more than a half dozen black players.
Right.
There was an unwritten quota that they didn't want more than a half dozen for a couple reasons. They were afraid the players couldn't get along in the locker room, and they didn't want to upset their boosters. And the sports media didn't really write about it because they did not want to alienate their advertisers or even their subscribers. So this just went on and on. And USC is actually a poor example of progress in the 1960s, of a progressive program in the 60s.
Right.
They only had five black players
And when you and you always said that, and when you said that, when I read that in the book, it just like set off a light bulb in me, because at the time, again, as a kid, I'm looking at USC, excuse me, and I'm looking at, you know, even during the time of O.J. Simpson, during that same period, I'm assuming, looking at the games on Wide World of Sports on ABC, that this is a predominantly black team.
Yeah, and that's because Mike Garrett, the 65 Heisman Trophy winner, and O.J., the 67 Heisman Trophy winner, were scoring all the touchdowns. So that was your impression. And like I say, the media, for the most part, was not documenting what was going on. My first hint of that was when I dug into the archives for my first book, Ray of Light, and there was an Associated Press report that Michigan State's 17 black athletes was the most in major college football history. Now, that didn't mean they broke the record of 16 because everybody else was down in single digits. It just meant that this one writer decided he was going to show how different Michigan State was. And the primary difference of why they were different was, first of all, Duffy Doherty didn't care about color.
Right.
And then Duffy Doherty would give an undersized black kid like Jimmy Ray, like Sherman Lewis, All-American halfback on the 63 team, a chance. Whereas the rest of the schools, if you're only going to take five black players, you're going for what we call today the five-star recruit, and O.J. Simpson. So that was the reason that Michigan State was so far out ahead. And we didn't really see it until the game of the century, which had a record TV audience of 33 million.
That's right. And, you know, the thing I didn't realize, because I want to get into the whole thing about USC, you know, talk more about USC, the game with USC and Alabama, the Sam, the Bam Cunningham, Bear Bryant game. But I didn't realize, I want you to put this in here too, and you talk about it in the book, the same day, you have the Stanford-Arkansas game. And talk about the relevancy of that game compared to the USC-Alabama game, because I never realized that.
Yeah, again, nobody did. I didn't even realize it until I stumbled across it. I was in the Los Angeles Times archives looking for some more information about the 1970 USC-Alabama game, which I had already debunked. There was no overnight reaction. People weren't talking about how this was changing sports. Those myths weren't made up until 20 years after the game. It was made up by USC mythmakers to aggrandize their own school. And then, of course, Alabama was quick to embrace it because it covered up Bear Bryant's long track record of having segregated teams. But anyways, I was looking through the LA Times, and here was a story about Stanford the same day playing at Arkansas. And the Stanford-Arkansas game was the one nationally televised, not USC-Alabama. And that's because Stanford had Jim Plunkett as the leading Heisman Trophy candidate. And the Arkansas quarterback was also considered a Heisman candidate. But Arkansas was ranked number 4. And if you remember, they had almost won the national title in 69. So they're coming off a huge season. And that's the game ABC put on TV. That's the game Dan Jenkins went to cover for Sports Illustrated. Nobody paid attention to the USC-Alabama game. And in fact, Dan Jenkins, in his Stanford-Arkansas story, talks about John Richardson, the first black player at Arkansas, making his debut, because back in those, he was as a sophomore, back in those days, freshmen weren't eligible. Well, that's another strike against his USC-Alabama myth, because USC didn't sign a black player until 1970. They were behind Arkansas. Actually, they were behind everybody. The Alabama was the seventh of 10 SEC schools to sign a black player. Bear Bryant was at the back of the bus, but he's had the greatest folklore and myth-making machine in the history of sports behind him, and they've completely changed the narrative.
And I always thought, you know, in my little mind, I always thought that Bear Bryant, you know, became this pioneer that he just opened up the SEC, just the South in general. Yeah. But yeah. As your book shows.
And Greg, getting back to that, your question, I skipped over the part. I was going through the archives, and I started reading about how the fullback at Stanford ran wild. He had 149 total yards and 3 touchdowns. That was more yards and more touchdowns than Sam Cunningham at USC. And his name was Hillary Shockley. That didn't ring a bell with me. So I said, if this guy is black, it'll be unbelievable. Not only was Hillary Shockley black from a Los Angeles high school, but the and he was the fullback, but the tailback was black, a guy from Tacoma, Washington. And then, of course, Jim Plunkett was Hispanic. So here you had Stanford with an all-minority backfield the same night with a more important performance than USC. But the only thing you hear about is USC, the all-minority backfield, Sam Cunningham, Bear Bryant tricking his racist fans by inviting Sam Cunningham to come down and run over his team so that George Wallace would let him, Bear Bryant, recruit black players. Well, George Wallace wasn't even in office in 1970.
Yeah, that's
been out of office.
That's so funny. When I read that, I said, I forgot that. Yeah.
And then the other thing is Cunningham wasn't even the starter. It was a guy named Charlie Evans, who was a white fullback and who was good enough to go out and play in the NFL. And he doesn't get mentioned in this myth at all. But he also scored a touchdown that night.
And it's, if anyone's ever been to USC, as far as if not actually attending the school, just visiting the campus, USC is right in the middle of, at the time, a black community. It's in Watts, actually. And you would think, you know, I guess that's the assumption, because of that, the assumption would be that, oh, yeah, they have all these black football players there.
Yeah, no.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like I was saying, they had 5 black players on their 62 national title team, 7 on their 67 national title teams. And with the population and diversity of Los Angeles, you had to work hard to keep your numbers down that low.
Right. I mean, you had to. That's a conscious effort.
Here's another insulting thing about USC that they got away with this myth. Showtime did a documentary on the 1970 USC Alabama game that is just has wildly inaccurate statements, and because it's narrated by Tom Selleck, it gets a lot of a veneer of credibility. But early in the film, they talk about Bryce Taylor.
Right.
USC's first black All-American player in 1925, like an example of USC being ahead of the times. Well, USC left him out of their media guide until the late 50s, when a guy from the Los Angeles Sentinel, the black newspaper in Los Angeles, exposed it. So that's how much interested they were in black athletes.
And meanwhile, you got UCLA. Talk about, and I've talked about that camp, especially in the late 30s. What's going on there? And that doesn't really, get to play.
UCLA was the progressive school in Los Angeles, not USC. And, once a myth gets started, it's hard to break it. It's I've talked about this with Hal Raines, the former New York Times executive editor, because he's written a fascinating book that I mentioned on one of my podcasts, where many of the soldiers in Sherman's army that marched into Atlanta
were
Northern Alabamians who, they were for poor Northern farmers in Alabama who didn't have slaves, and they were against secession, but they were written out of history, a lot like Duffy Doherty and Michigan State teams have been written out of history by this 1970 USC Alabama myth that favors Bear Bryant.
Amazing. And it's really amazing. And that's something, you talk about in the book that I didn't know, that really, everything in the book, I want to say. And by the way, if you're just listening to the program, talking to Tom Shanahan, no, he's not connected with the Mike Shanahan. Well, I don't know. Maybe you are, but He's the author of a new book, The Right Thing to Do, and it's all about the transitional players of college football integration in the 1960s. And one thing you mentioned in the book that I didn't know nothing about, and I was like, there was a point, you know, I used to cover sports in Colorado where I basically at one point lived in Folsom Field in Boulder, Colorado. And I never knew the story about the 62 Orange Bowl game. And talk about that whole thing. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's such an injustice. It's such a shame, really, because what if the story had been told in 61? Does that move the ball forward earlier in racial understanding? And that's particularly important in Boulder because when Bill McCartney had success with a lot of black players, they were getting arrested. The story that Sports Illustrated wrote, Rick Riley wrote, was that, you know, there must be an element of racism in Boulder. And I've never lived in Boulder, so I don't know. But my point is, Riley was starting from this example in the late 80s, where actually Boulder's story goes back to 1961, where Joe Romig, the team captain, Rhodes Scholar, College Football Hall of Fame, and Chuck McBride, who was also a team captain, later better known for his time as Nebraska's defensive coordinator of the Blackshirts, they organized, they threatened to boycott the 1962 Orange Bowl if their five black player teammates, that's all, just five, they stood up for five black players, if they were not allowed to stay in the same hotel, eat in the same restaurant, ride the same buses as any other American citizen. And how this story got ignored is just unbelievable and such a shame. But it's really not unbelievable if you also looked at this was what was unbelievable to me. That same year in 1961, and I won first place from the Football Writers Association of America for this story. Bear Bryant was maneuvering behind the scenes to sneak in to the 1960 Rose Bowl because there was a lapse in the Big Ten contract with the West Coast. And when UCLA's players, eight black players, again, more than USC, UCLA's eight black players led by Kermit Alexander, got wind of it, they were upset and they threatened to boycott the Rose Bowl. And the point being, Kermit told me that if, you know, we can't play on their field in Alabama, why should they be able to play on our field in Pasadena? So this story really, Jim Murray did write about it. And when he exposed it, it blew up Bear Bryant's scheme. But the story has been misconstrued over time. Because there's a subplot that Ohio State won the Big Ten and the faculty voted they weren't going to let Ohio State go because they were afraid Woody Hayes was turning Ohio State into a football factory.
Right.
Which is so funny when you think back on it. And the way that story is told to favor Alabama, and it was again when Alabama played in the Rose Bowl against Michigan. I wrote this ahead of time. Watch, this is going to happen. And that's what Alabama people were writing. They wrote that once Ohio State was out of the picture, people started saying, wouldn't it be nice to let Alabama Bear Bryant coach in the Rose Bowl since he also played in it? But that's not what happened. Bear Bryant was maneuvering before Ohio State ever clinched the Big Ten title, and the faculty vote wasn't until after the title. So that's all backwards. Bear Bryant was scheming from the beginning, and once the UCLA players, with the help of Jim Murray, exposed it, it blew up. And at the same time, you had this going on with Colorado's magnanimous team standing up for just five black players. That can't be emphasized enough.
Right.
So here's these two great moments in racial progress being made in college sports, and the media ignored them all. And the only way I got onto it, I always knew that I got onto the Rose Bowl thing because Jim Murray wrote about it. And when I decided to dig in more to it, that's when I was able to show that the Ohio State timeline and the Bear Bryant maneuvering timeline were overlapped. But anyways, the only reason I found out about Colorado is while I was researching this book, The Right Thing to Do, The True Pioneers of College Football and Integration in the 1960s, I wanted to write more about Bear Bryant's 1970 team losing to integrated teams by lopsided scores.
Right.
Because that's the other part of the shock, the other part of the 1970 myth that USC made up, that it was such a shock to the Alabama fans. They didn't know what to think. Well, 1 year earlier, Tennessee's integrated team won at Alabama 41-14. And the star of the game was a two-time All-American linebacker, a black guy, Jackie Walker, the first black linebacker in the SEC. That's in October 69. Then in the Liberty Bowl, 1969, December, Colorado rolled up 47 points. Colorado, of course, being integrated, rolled up 47 points to beat Alabama, 47-33. So I called so in essence, the USC is the third team in less than a year to roll up 40 points on
right.
Alabama. It was not a shock anymore. So I called up Dave Platty, the Colorado Sports.
I know him very well.
Yeah, he's a pro. And I wanted to find out more information about the Liberty Bowl. And then he was the one that told me about the 1961 Colorado team in the Orange Bowl. Because I guess it finally got written about it at the 50th anniversary. But again, the story didn't spread outside of Boulder or Denver. And when Dave put me in touch with Joe Romig and a guy named John Meadows, who was on that team too, I was just flabbergasted at the story they told me. I don't know how that story was kept under wraps for so long, but it's a story that needs to be told. And when you understand the big picture, it just shows us more and more what baloney the 1970 USC Alabama game was.
Definitely. To
college football integration. And that Bear Bryant dragged his feet. He was not a crusader. He resisted integration as longer than most coaches. I think I said this earlier. They were the seventh of 10 SEC teams to integrate. And by the 1970 season, when Alabama had its first black player, 33 of the 37 major programs were integrated. Bear Bryant was at the back of the bus. He's a phony.
Yeah, and I mean, but they want to play that role with. And the fact is that he's Bear Bryant. He's not Paul Bryant. You know, he's this.
Yeah.
You know, for some of the younger listeners that are listening, I mean, some folks may know the name. Just think of him when you see pictures of him. This kindly guy, in this.
Yep.
You know, just so
he knew how to manipulate the media.
Yeah.
They've treated him as the folksy old bear. And, you know, that's the other thing I'm starting to talk about when I get a chance to appear on a show like this and someone will pay attention to my book, is it's a sports journalism failure, not only in the 1960s that these stories weren't written about and Michigan State wasn't given its proper credit, and guys like Jerry Levias, the
right.
first black player at SMU who played through death threats, and James Owen at Auburn a year ahead of Alabama integrated, Tennessee, I already mentioned, Bob
right.
Grant at Wake Forest in 1964. These are the guys who made the 1970 USC Alabama game possible. And Jerry Levias played through death threats. His teammates were afraid to stand next to him on the sideline. And you're going to tell me that Sam Cunningham running through massive five holes of a bad team was the one who spurred integration is pure baloney. But the point I was also wanted to make was, not only is it a failure that it wasn't told properly in the 1960s, it's a failure that the Sports Illustrated, ESPN, The Athletic,
You name it.
National outlets, they continue to
right
sell
now. That's
the Bear Bryant myth, the Sam Cunningham myth. And I've pitched some of the stories that you see in my book to these national outlets, and they've rejected them.
That's amazing.
That song and dance.
It's amazing on the one hand, but it's like the quote, and you use the quote in the book from the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
You know, what's more important? You know, basically
go print the legend. Right.
That's right. Forget the facts.
But I also think they're all afraid of Bear Bryant's legacy. They don't want to take it on.
And it's a huge legacy. Unfortunately, it is a huge one. I mean, you think about
one.
Yeah. And, I mean, there have been movies. I mean, besides documentaries out now, movies made about him. But Duffy Doherty, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think there's been a movie. There have been some documentaries, but an actual movie about him, about what he did.
Not a movie, not a documentary.
No,
he's been completely stripped of his throne by these myths that are easy to break apart. You read my book. You read my book. Jack Ebling, who has a Lansing Sports Radio show and has been supportive of my work, he said you have to have a learning disability to read this book and still think Bear Bryant was a hero.
That's right. I mean, if you believe that, you know, I got some land, I will sell you some quicksand or something, I'll sell it to you. But you know, one thing you forget, you didn't mention, as far as talking about CU, talk very briefly about who the coach is. But you forgot to mention that. That's in the book. That's really important.
Yeah. Well, that all kind of just tied together. You know, it was an interesting thing. I mentioned about how I learned about it from Dave Platty. I started to realize after I wrote Ray of Light, focused on Jimmy Ray and the 65-66 teams, because I say that Jimmy Ray is the most – Bubba Smith was the most famous Michigan State player because he was in the police – besides being a legendary football player, he was in the Police Academy movies. George Webster is unquestionably the greatest. Nobody disputes that at Michigan State, even the guys on those 65-66 teams. But I say in Ray of Light that Jimmy Ray is the most socially significant because he broke down barriers as a black quarterback and then as a black coach. Although he didn't get his chance as a head coach, he was still a mentor to many black coaches. He was only the second black coordinator in the NFL in 1983 with the Los Angeles Rams. And Tony Dungy on down looks up to Jimmy Ray as a mentor. But anyways, as I did all that research later, I started to realize that Duffy's first staff was in 1954 when he was named head coach. On that staff was Dan Devine, Bob Devaney, Bill Yeoman, and then Sonny Grandelius, who went off to Colorado. And I started to realize that all of these guys at the schools they went to followed Duffy's blueprint of ignoring the quota limitations of the time. So that meant Dan Devine was recruiting more black players in Arizona State. And when he left for Missouri, he had brought with him Frank Cush, another Michigan State man.
Right.
He was a player on those Duffy Doherty, Biggie Munn teams. And Frank continued what Dan started. So then Dan goes to Missouri, and Missouri, whoever tells you this, Missouri had two black players in 1958. They were the first team in the South with black players. Although it's not the Confederate South, it's still the South. Who knows that fact? And Dan Devine was the coach, and he had Missouri up in double digits with black players in the 60s. And then this part surprised me. Even when he went to Notre Dame in 1976, because remember I told you Notre Dame only had one black player in 1966. And When Dan Devine's first full recruiting class was 1976, he had 10 black players. One of them was Vegas Ferguson. They're All-American. Right. And Vegas Ferguson helped me with the research on this because Notre Dame Sports Information Department only helps national outlets. They're not very helpful.
Really?
But anyways, the
That's a story in itself. That's another story.
It wasn't that way when Roger Valdeseri was there in the Arap Parsegian ways, but it is now. They don't even return your calls. So anyways, Vegas was happy to help me. I like to say he's the first All-American who's ever worked for me. he went through all the information because he had always been thinking about it himself. And the 10 black players in his recruiting class, his freshman class, was the most in Notre Dame history under Dan Devine. Bob Devaney goes to Wyoming, recruits their first black players. Then he moves on to Nebraska, and he recruits a fully integrated team in Nebraska, wins two national titles. Bill Yeoman goes down to Houston, desegregates Houston with Warren McVay in 1964. And in addition to that, and then Sonny Grandelis, I mentioned, went to Colorado. In addition to those guys, Earl Edwards had coached with Duffy and Biggie Munn before he went off to North Carolina State. He desegregated NC State's program. And then one final name, Chuck Fairbanks, who, like Frank Cush, played on the Biggie Munn, Duffy Doherty teams. He was the head coach at Oklahoma. And then all these guys are dead, so I was able to talk to like their sons and things. But Barry Switzer was Fairbanks' offensive coordinator, and so I was able to talk to him. And Barry said that he and Chuck were of the same mindset because Oklahoma's coach had died suddenly from a heart attack, and Chuck was promoted to head coach at a time they had, I think, maybe 3, 4, 5 at the most black players. And Barry Switzer told me that he and Chuck were of the same mindset. They were going to recruit as many black players as they wanted at any position. And that's what Oklahoma did. So then next, you have the 1971 game of the century, Oklahoma and Nebraska. And Duffy Doherty's fingerprints are on those because Devaney was a Duffy assistant and Chuck Fairbanks was influenced by Duffy Doherty.
You know, I mean... Yeah, it's just so amazing.
It just goes on and on and on.
And it's a shame that people will talk about the coaching tree of Bill Parcells in sports or Bear Bryant, their coaching tree. They'll talk about Mike Shanahan's coaching tree, but you never hear about Duffy Doherty's and his relationship to so many schools, including CU, Colorado University. And, you know, Tom, I could talk to you about this all day. I mean, I got to get you back on. I got to get you back on to talk about the children's book you have. I got to check that out. About the underground. Yeah. I got to check that out. But what do you want people to get out of the book? What was your main goal?
I want people to honor the true pioneers. They're the ones who have been shoved into the shadows. Not just shoved into the shadows, but shoved into the shadows by fiction, deliberate fiction made up by USC people and embraced by Alabama people to hide Bear Bryant's dismal record on integration. And these black players, not just Duffy Doherty and the Michigan State teams and the Duffy Doherty coaching tree. It's not just them, because what Michigan State was doing helped push open doors in the South because it was running parallel to what Martin Luther King was doing. So you had your first black players at Kentucky in 66, Tennessee in 67, Wake Forest in 1964, Houston with Warren McVay in 1964. And again, I like to say this as many times as I can. Auburn, 1969, 1 year before Bear Bryant in Alabama. The Wilbur big Jackson. Excuse for Bear, Big excuse for Bear Bryant apologists. Oh, Bear Bryant couldn't sign a black player, or else George Wallace would have fired him. Well, nobody fired Auburn's coach, Shook Jordan, and he was a year ahead of Bryant.
That's right.
So, and as I mentioned earlier about Jerry Levias, had the FBI escorting him to and from the locker room because they deemed the one death threat against TCU to be credible. And he played through that game and scored a 68-yard touchdown Amazing. Catch, which clinched the Southwest title for
Amazing.
SMU.
And we could do a whole show around him alone. I mean, that is,
yeah,
that story yeah. is something. But I'm sorry to cut you off because we have to go now. But how can people get a hold of you, Tom?
Yeah,
because I want to have you back on.
First of all, my website is tomshanahan.report, and my contact information is on there, and also purchase links to The Right Thing to Do, Ray of Light, and my children's book that you mentioned, Bubba's Dad, Duffy, and College Football's Underground Railroad. And my idea behind that children's book was, after I wrote Ray of Light, I realized I also did not give enough credit to the Southern black high school coaches who were sending right. Duffy the players. And wow. chief among them was Bubba Smith's dad, Willie Ray Smith, a legendary coach in Texas. He won 235 games and two black state titles. And one thing that I haven't said on this show that I always like to say, Duffy Doherty did not recruit the segregated South. The segregated South recruited Duffy.
That's right.
These black coaches sent their players to Duffy because they trusted him.
That is something. And I just want to say to my listeners out there that I that I've interviewed many folks over the years, over 20 years now, and read many books. And this is one of the most passionate books. I'm so happy, Tom, that you show your passion in this book. You don't play. You don't yeah. just give cold numbers and just say, "Okay, this is it." I mean, you say this is wrong. You don't. You yeah, know. You don't yeah, pull. Yeah. I'm just happy you don't pull any punches. You just let it out, and I'm just happy you did.
I really appreciate you giving me a chance to tell the story, because my problem is I have a major story to tell, but I don't have a major publisher's budget to promote it. And it's I'll take every opportunity I can to break through. I'm hopefully I'm going to find that tripwire that triggers this nationally.
I hope so. Maybe this interview will do it. You know, you never know. But Tom, thank you so much. I'll be talking to you later. Just thank you so much. You've written a great book, a great website, and you're just you should be in the College Hall of Fame, really, for what the work you're doing.
I don't know about that, but I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. You take care, Tom. And I love folks who are so dedicated to their work. Tom Shanahan is doing a great job, uncovering the hidden history of what happened in the 60s as far as integration and college sports, college football. But actually, it turns out to be college sports in general. And also, in America itself. Fascinating book. Check it out. Definitely check it out. But we're going to, before we get out of here, I'll do a little music. And I was digging for this one. Found this. This is, had to go through the bottom of my basement to find this one. But this is the chairman of the board. And this is from the late 60s, around that time period that Tom wrote about. And this is, I'm a Sign of Changing Times. So let's hear that. By the chairman of the board on the Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast.
Thank you. afraid of me. Folks, I come to set you free. You see, I am the way things ought to be. I'm a sign of changing times. Come to liberate your mind. Forget the way things used to be. I'm a sign of changing times. 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 I'm a sign of changing.
Got so dirty here going through the basement trying to find that one, but I hope you enjoyed that. That was the chairman of the board from 1969, and I'm a sign of changing times. And we're getting ready to get out of here now. Hope you enjoyed the interview. I know you did with Tom Shanahan talking about his new book, and please get that book. Please get it. The right thing to do, the right thing for you to do is to get that book. It's on August Publications. Check it out. Great book, and as well as his other books about the integration of college football in the 1960s. But again, this is Greg Rashid on the Show to Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast. Go in love, go in peace. Help someone along the way. But every day, when you wake up in the morning, get up, look in that mirror, hug yourself and say, I love myself. And if you're sight impaired, get up, hug yourself, and say, I love myself. Because if you don't love yourself, you can't do anything. You can't do a single thing. You don't love yourself. I mean, it's no point even getting up some days. But anyway, love yourself. Because we all are in this together. We're on the same spear together. So do what you can. There's a lot of problems in the world. A lot of wars going on. You know, but you can do something in your own way. Bringing some positive energy to whatever community you are in this world. Help a senior, help a young person, do what you can. Help your neighbor, help those in need, do what you can, because we're all in this together. So again, this is Greg Rashid. Go in love and go in peace. We'll see you next time on the Show to Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast. And remember, you want to be a Patreon? Go to my Patreon site, Show to Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast, and donate what you can, $1 a month, $1 a week, whatever you can, to keep this show rolling so we can get some better equipment. Also go to my Buy Me a Coffee site and donate whatever you can, $1 or so. Keep things going, because this is your program. We depend on you out there to keep things rolling. So again, this is Greg Rashid. Go in love, go in peace. See you next time on the Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in, my friends. See you next time for another edition of the Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing Podcast. Please don't forget to like, share, comment, and subscribe to this podcast. Thanks.